let's turn in our Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 14. As we've been studying 1 Samuel so far, we have, for the most part, been taking one chapter per week. But chapter 14 has 52 verses, and that seems a bit ambitious for a single message. So we're going to consider the first 23 verses this morning. And there's a transition in the text at that point, so it will be an appropriate place for us to break the chapter. So let's begin by reading the first 23 verses of 1 Samuel 14. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave, or as most of your translations have it, under the pomegranate tree at Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men, including Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on one side and a rocky crag on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Sene. The one crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, the other on the south in front of Geba. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." And his armor-bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you, heart and soul." Then Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross over to the men, and we will show ourselves to them. If they say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand still in our place, and we will not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand. And this shall be the sign to us." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves." And the men of this garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, "Come up to us, and we will show you a thing." And Jonathan said to the armor-bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor-bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer killed them after him. And that first strike which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made killed about 20 men within, as it were, half a furrow's length in an acre of land. And there was a panic in the camp, in the field, and among the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. And the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here and there. And Saul said to the people who were with him, "Count and see who has gone from us." And when they had counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. So Saul said to Elijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel. Now, while Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into the battle. And behold, every Philistine sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. Now the Hebrews, who had been with the Philistines before that time, and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel, who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim, heard that the Philistines were fleeing. They too followed hard after them in the battle, So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth-Aven. I'd like to break the passage down into three sections this morning, the first of which we'll consider under the heading, Unguided Folly. And this is going to cover primarily verses 2 and 3, where we'll see Saul and those whom he has surrounded himself with camped out around Gibeah. But before we get into this here in chapter 14, I want to remind you what happened in chapter 13. Remember that Saul had been sent to Gilgal and told to wait. He was supposed to wait for Samuel to come and bring Saul instructions from God for how God would use Saul to deliver Israel from the Philistines. So Saul waited the 7 days that Samuel had told him it would take for Samuel to come. But Samuel didn't arrive when Saul expected him. Now, Saul should have kept waiting. The point was not that he should wait a particular amount of time, 7 days in this case. The point was to wait and not proceed until he had been given the instructions that God had for him. But Saul got impatient. He was tired of waiting. And so when the 7 days was up, at least by Saul's count, he decided to move forward. And he began by offering sacrifices. And as soon as Saul was done with the sacrifices, Samuel arrived. So apparently, it was just a little later on the same day that he had said he was going to arrive. And Samuel said to Saul, "What have you done?" And this was really more a rebuke than a question. Saul immediately started blaming everyone but himself. The people were scattering. Samuel wasn't there. The Philistines were breathing down his neck. And even the Lord, Saul implied, required a sacrifice before he would show Saul his favor. So Saul said that he forced himself, as if Saul were the one who was being put upon in all of this. Samuel told Saul that he acted foolishly and that there was a consequence, a tragic consequence. There were really two consequences that we see in the text. The first one Samuel spelled out for Saul. The kingdom was going to be taken away from him and from his family. God had chosen another man, a man after God's own heart, and he would be the new king of Israel. The second consequence is in verse 15, and we have to look closely to see it. It says that Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal. And you know what he did not do before he left? He did not give Saul any instructions from the Lord. The instructions that Saul was supposed to have been waiting for. The instructions that Saul needed in order to be God's instrument when God delivered Israel from the Philistines. That is why I titled this section, Unguided Folly. Because Saul, as a result of his unwillingness to wait on God as the deliverer of Israel, was left unguided by God in this time of crisis when Israel really needed God's deliverance. Now, Saul had no idea what to do. He was left on his own because he refused to wait on the Lord. And so we find Saul in verse 2 sitting under a pomegranate tree outside of Gibeah. Well, it's either a tree or a cave. The ESV is the only translation I know of that says cave. And if cave is right, then Saul is hiding in a hole in the ground, just like the other Israelites who were afraid of the Philistines. That's what it said in verse 6 of the previous chapter. When the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard-pressed, the people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in tombs and in cisterns. But I think tree is what's intended here. And that just makes Saul look ridiculous, sitting under a pomegranate tree while the country is occupied by Philistines. I think that is what the writer wants us to see. He was so lost at this point that he didn't know what to do. So he plopped himself down under a pomegranate tree, and there he sat. And his situation was hopeless. Without the Lord to guide him and to deliver him and Israel, Saul didn't stand a chance against the Philistines. He had 600 men, and they were armed with garden tools. In chapter 13, we read that only Saul and Jonathan had sword or spear. And the Philistines had thousands of chariots and thousands of horsemen and more troops than you could count. So yes, without the Lord's help, it was hopeless. And Saul had no idea what he should do. And look what he had done. As part of Saul's 600 men, he had Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh. And I know that's a little confusing, trying to sort through how they're all related. But it comes down to this, that Ahijah was Eli's grandson. You remember Eli. He tolerated his wicked sons and the corruption and immorality that they brought to the priesthood. So God judged the house of Eli and removed them from the priesthood. In 1 Samuel 3, verses 13 and 14, when God called Samuel, he said this about Eli, "And I declare to him that I am about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew, because his sons were blaspheming God and he did not restrain them. Therefore, I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." Now, it wouldn't have been a problem if Elijah had been there with Saul as a soldier, but he wasn't there as a soldier. It says he was wearing an ephod. In Exodus 28, an ephod was prescribed as one of the garments to be worn by the priest, and specifically by Aaron, the high priest. So what was Ahijah, whose family had been cut off from the priesthood, doing there wearing an ephod? Apparently, Saul thought he needed a high priest, and Samuel had left him, or more accurately, God had withdrawn his priest from Saul. Now, I don't know if Saul thought that he was going to lure God back and he thought that a priest would help him do that, or if he just thought that the king of Israel really ought to have a priest in tow. Regardless, he found the grandson of the previous high priest and he dressed him up in an ephod. Note that scripture does not call Ahijah a priest. He wasn't a priest. He was just a man dressed up in a priest costume. He makes the whole scene that much more ridiculous. Saul's pretend priest hanging out with Saul under a pomegranate tree. Now, Saul may not have known that Ahijah's family had been rejected by God. In fact, just a year earlier, Saul didn't even know who the current priest and prophet and judge of Israel was. So it's unlikely that he did know what happened with the priesthood a generation before. And that epitomized Saul's circumstances now. He just didn't know. He was stumbling around in the dark. He was unguided, uninformed, unwise. He had abandoned God, so God rejected him. And all he was left with was his own folly. And you want to talk about unguided folly? Later in the chapter, in verse 18, Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here, for the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel." Because that had worked out so well for Israel the last time they brought God's ark to a battle. And yet here was God's rejected king and God's rejected priest taking it on themselves to cart around God's ark. It's not just unguided folly, it's misguided folly. So backing up to verses 2 and 3, this is where Saul was, without any direction at all, and an army of Philistines in the land. Now I'd like to turn your attention to Saul's son, Jonathan. Jonathan stands in stark contrast with his father, and we will consider him under the heading Courageous Faith. In verse 1, Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go to the Philistine garrison on the other side." Just based on this verse, we wouldn't be able to tell if this was courageous faith or reckless bravado. It says that Jonathan did not tell his father his plan, which suggests that Saul would have thought him foolhardy. It's also possible that Saul blamed Jonathan for causing this whole mess. After all, it was Jonathan who had defeated the Philistine garrison in Geba, which caused Israel to become a stench to the Philistines and led them to mustering an army to come against Israel. So perhaps Saul wouldn't have wanted Jonathan to make a bad situation even worse by further provoking the Philistines. In verses 4 and 5, the author provides us with some topography to help us visualize what Jonathan would have to deal with just to get to the Philistines. What the author calls passes, you would probably call a canyon or a gorge. It was a deeply cut, natural ravine with steep, rocky crags on either side. Jonathan and his armor bearer were on the ridge above the pass on one side, and the Philistines were on the opposite ridge across the pass. One of the rocky crags, the one on the side of the Philistines, was called Bozez, which roughly means slippery. The rocky crag on the other side, where Jonathan was called Sene. Sene roughly means thorny. So for Jonathan and his armor bearer to reach the Philistines, it was a steep and treacherous descent through thorny, followed by an equally steep and treacherous climb over slippery. That is what they were facing. And then in verse 6, we see the nature of Jonathan's faith and his courage. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." "It may be," Jonathan said. Other translations say, "Perhaps the Lord will help us." Jonathan didn't presume to know the mind of God on this question. And this is so refreshing. It is so good to see a man who did not insist on what God must do or what God must be thinking beyond what God had revealed in his word or through his prophet. Jonathan's example here is often used by faithful ministers of the gospel to address an abuse by some in the church. Too often today, people do what they want to do, or what seems right to them, and they claim that they are stepping out in faith. Perhaps a local church decides to build a new building or to add on to an existing one, but they lack the means to do so. So they project their desires onto God, and they assure themselves that the Lord will work for us, and he will do so in the particular way that they want him to work. That is not faith. That is presumption and manipulation. I say the passage is often used this way to make this point, and I believe that that is an appropriate lesson to draw from this text, and I affirm that. And we ought not to presume to know what God wills and what he will do except for what he has revealed to us in his word. But I believe that there is something else going on in this statement. "It may be that the Lord will work for us." that is more fundamental to the circumstances of what was happening in Israel with the king at that time. You see, God had promised to deliver Israel from their enemies if they kept his covenant. And now that they had a king, God would deliver Israel if their king would lead them into God's deliverance. That was the deal. Those were God's terms. As long as the king would submit to being God's instrument of deliverance and not try to usurp God as the deliverer himself, God would work for them. So, if Israel, under their king, had submitted to God in this, then it would have been right for Jonathan to say, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised, to those who have no covenant with God and no right to be in this land that he promised to our fathers, and the Lord will work for us. The Lord will deliver us because he promised that he would." But Saul, as Israel's king, had rebelled against God in this. Saul had tried to be the deliverer on his own, and God had rejected Saul because of it. That is why Jonathan, the prince of Israel, cannot say here with certainty, "God will work for us today and deliver us today." He cannot say that because of what his father had done. Otherwise, he could have. But Jonathan has so much faith in God as a God of grace that he is able to say, "It may be even now, if we submit ourselves to him and rely on him to save us, that he will save us. For nothing can hinder the Lord. He can save by the many. He can save by the few. He can use the king as his instrument, or he can use the prince, or he can use a shepherd boy. Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases." And what other hope does Israel have? If God doesn't save Israel, then who will? And this isn't Jonathan saying, "Let's risk everything to rush in on the chance that God might do something." They have nothing left to lose. They need God to deliver them. And the safest course of action has to be to actively seek God's deliverance. Do you see what Jonathan was doing here? He was completely putting himself in God's hands. He sought God's deliverance, firmly convinced that God could deliver him. And he did so without any fallback plan whatsoever. Many of you are familiar with Jim Elliot's quote, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." And this applies to Jonathan. If he did nothing, he would have been on the run, living in caves, eating what he could scavenge off the land until the Philistines eventually tracked him down, abused him, and killed him. So instead, he trusted himself to God because Jonathan believed that if God chose, God could deliver. Now, consider what Jonathan was proposing. That they slide down what is essentially a cliff through rocks and thorns, that they would cross the pass and then climb up the slippery side to reach the Philistines. And when they got to the Philistines, they would fight this well-armed, well-trained garrison of soldiers, just the two of them, Jonathan and his armor-bearer. It was, to say the least, a courageous plan. Some would call it heroic, but Jonathan never put any of his trust in his own efforts. He was not counting on his own rock climbing ability, or on his skill in fighting, or on the strength of his arm, or anything else that he provided. In fact, when he said, "For nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by the many or by the few," He means that God was not limited by Jonathan's own helplessness. He implies that God is just as able to deliver in these circumstances that apart from God are utterly hopeless. That's what he's saying here. He's saying, I know I'm helpless, but God can still save me. And this should be instructive for us. Looking to God for deliverance does not mean that we don't act. We do act. We walk in the deliverance that God accomplishes for us. But, like Jonathan, we must never think that we are accomplishing or even contributing to our own deliverance by our actions. And that's why it's called faith. It was faith because Jonathan was solely counting on God to deliver. And it was courageous because he was willing to scale cliffs and attack the enemy in order to experience God's deliverance. And Jonathan was not the only one here with courageous faith. His armor bearer isn't even given a name in our text. And this wasn't his plan. This wasn't his idea. And yet, when he was presented with the invitation to seek deliverance from God, he put everything in God's hands. He embraced it. Do all that is in your heart, he said. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you, heart and soul. These two men were willing to put their trust in God and in God alone because they knew that he could deliver them. And he was their only hope. And now I'd like to consider the rest of our text under the heading of gracious deliverance. In verses 8 through 10, Jonathan shored up the details of their plan. They would show themselves to the Philistines and see how the Philistines responded. Would the Philistines attempt to come to them, to meet them in the pass? Then the two Israelites would wait. Or would the Philistines challenge Jonathan and his armor bearer to come up to the Philistine camp? If so, Jonathan would take that as a sign. Now, I don't know how Jonathan determined that this would be the sign. I would just observe that this would be the more difficult possibility if Jonathan and his armor bearer had to climb up out of the pass and fight the Philistines on their own turf. Now, others might have found this the discouraging possibility, but Jonathan took it as a sign that God was prepared to deliver them. And that was the Philistine response. In verses 11 and 12, when they saw the Israelites, they mocked them. "Look, Hebrews are coming up out of the holes where they have hidden themselves," they said. And they challenged them, "Come up to us, and we will show you a thing." Now, it's unlikely that it even occurred to the Philistines that the two men that they saw down on the pass below would actually attempt to come up to them. And so they likely just went about their business, doing whatever it was that they had been doing. But that's exactly what Jonathan did. He climbed up on his hands and his feet, and his armor bearer followed him. I can't help but think of the scene from the movie The Princess Bride when Wesley, or the Dread Pirate Roberts, was climbing the cliffs of insanity while Inigo Montoya waited at the top to fight him. Only in this case, there wasn't just one swordsman to fight. There was an entire Philistine garrison. And when they got to the top, God gave them victory over their enemies. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer killed them after him. And they killed about 20 men in that first strike. And this force moving through that camp, which was God using Jonathan and his armor bearer as God's instruments, caused such a panic in the camp that it says in verse 15, the garrison and even the raiders trembled. It says the earth quaked. And it became a very great panic. Some question whether we're supposed to understand this as a literal earthquake. And while I wouldn't be dogmatic on the point, I believe that we are. There's no reason that God couldn't or wouldn't use an earthquake to cause panic among the Philistines. And I believe that that's the best way to understand the text. Over the next four verses, Saul realized something was going on. They had watchmen posted who could see the Philistine camp. First, he figured out who was missing, Jonathan and his armor bearer. Then he called for his fake priest to bring out the ark. Saul was still going through the motions of religion, but he had no interest in seeking after God as Israel's deliverer. Then he quickly lost interest in the ark because he was eager to join a winning battle. And he soon told the priest, "Withdraw your hand," by which he meant, "Just forget it." In verse 20, Saul and the people who were with him managed to get over to the Philistine camp and join the battle. And then it says, "And behold, every Philistine's sword was against his fellow, and there was a very great confusion." I find it compelling that it says every Philistine's sword was against his fellow for two reasons. First, Israel had no swords, except for Jonathan and Saul. We saw that earlier in 1 Samuel 13, verse 22. There was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people with Saul and Jonathan. So what did God do? He used the Philistines' own swords against them. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few, by Hebrew swords or by Philistine swords, or by no swords at all. Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. The other reason that I find it compelling, that scripture specifically says it was the Philistines' own swords that were against them, is that Saul is left out. Yes, Saul and the people rallied and went into battle, but it doesn't say that God used them for Israel's deliverance, at least not in this victory over the Philistines on this day. A few verses later, in verse 23, it says, "So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth-Aven." The Lord saved Israel. He used Jonathan and his armor bearer. He used the Philistines' own swords. He even made the earthquake. But he did not use Saul because Saul had forfeited that privilege. Of course, God was not prevented from using Saul again if he chose to, and he would. God is a gracious God. He is Israel's deliverer, and he would yet use Saul to defeat Israel's enemies. Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. So there we have the first 23 verses of 1 Samuel chapter 14. We saw the unguided folly that seizes men when they reject God as their deliverer. How they flit about with religious trappings, like Saul, who made a priest for himself and then brought out God's ark. We also saw the courageous faith of a man who was so confident that God could deliver, that he was willing to scale a rocky crag and fight an army. He put his trust not in himself, but consigned himself to live or to die according to the workings of the Lord. And we saw God's gracious deliverance because God is a deliverer. He delivers those who trust in him. Psalm 37, verse 40 says, "The Lord helps them and delivers them. He delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in him." That's what he did for Jonathan and for Israel. So what should we make of this? The New Testament tells us that these things took place as examples for us. They were written for our instruction and encouragement, and that these Old Testament scriptures are able to make us wise for salvation through faith in Christ Jesus. How does 1 Samuel 14 do all of that? It's tempting to make the lesson, be active like Jonathan, not stagnant like Saul. Take risks, anticipating what God might do. Fight through your own thorns. Climb your own slippery crags. Attack your own Philistines. And that is the way this is often preached. But that is not what this is about. Primarily because it puts way too much emphasis on Jonathan's heroics. And by way too much, I mean any at all. This is not about Jonathan's heroics. This is about God's deliverance. And don't make the mistake of thinking that Jonathan had to do what he did so that God could deliver him. Jonathan did what he did because he anticipated that God might deliver him. But the deliverance was wholly and completely dependent on God. We need to be like Jonathan in that we are eager to walk in deliverance because we trust in God and God alone for that deliverance. Because it's so easy to fall back into religion where we take responsibility for delivering ourselves from whatever enemies we may encounter. This past Wednesday, I picked Jillian up after school, and as we were driving home, she told me about a boy who had figured out how to push her buttons. He seemed to delight in getting a rise out of her. And she said to me, "Dad, I don't want to react in situations like that, but sometimes I do." And that was her concern, how she reacted. When I heard this, two thoughts immediately entered my mind, and both of them were wrong. The first thought was, someone needs to straighten that boy out. Well, that wasn't wrong. Someone does need to straighten him out, but that's not my responsibility, so I let that one go. The other thought was this. It occurred to me to tell Jillian that she needed to resolve not to let him get to her, that she needed to control her reaction and anticipate these situations and prepare herself to resist. That would have been horrible, anti-gospel advice, because it was all based on her own efforts. "Are you so foolish?" Paul wrote to the Galatians in Galatians 3, verse 3. And it's as if he was writing directly to me. "Having begun by the Spirit, are you now being perfected by the flesh?" Thankfully, the Spirit convicted me before I opened my mouth and misled my daughter. And so we discussed the situation in light of the gospel. She had identified an issue in her life, the way she reacted to this boy, where her flesh desired something that was not spiritually healthy for her and wasn't glorifying to God. And she needed deliverance from it through the continued application of the gospel. Oh, she may have been able to modify her behavior in some other way. There may have been things that she could have done to mitigate her outward reactions. But it is only the blood of Christ that can purify our inner beings and deliver us from the dead works of our own efforts. There will never be true victory over any sin unless God delivers you from it. And then you can act out of courageous faith and exercise Spirit-produced self-control. That doesn't mean that your experience is going to be any easier than Jonathan and his armor-bearer in the thorns and the crags and in the midst of the Philistines. But the outcome won't depend on you. You will be walking in the deliverance that God has accomplished in you. And this isn't just for school children dealing with little Philistines on the playground. This is for you. We need to stop trying to address our sin on our own. We need to trust God as our only deliverer, who can save us not just one day when he calls us home, but can cause us to walk in victory here on earth all the days of our life. Let's pray.